Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at RackSteel.com. Now joining us to talk about, I guess, that game last night and what's next for the Canucks going into the offseason, all of it. He is the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, our pal Brendan Batchelor. Batch, what's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. It's a nice sunny day outside. I went out and touched some grass and smelled some flowers this morning and felt pretty good. So you guys
look at you.
A good day, too.
Did somebody tell you angrily on Twitter to touch grass, or you just took your own initiative?
No, I took my own initiative.
Wow.
But I would encourage many of our listeners who might be having a tough day to do the same thing, and they might feel better.
Coming in hot, Batch, just telling everyone to go touch grass. I love it. I mean, look, it's good advice. Touching grass is great. It's very good advice. All right. So, I mean, I guess we should start with the results last night. Drantz and I were kind of debating or talking, at least in the first segment, you know, did they quit or was it just like, how would you characterize it? Was the effort there? Did they just get outplayed? How would you kind of sum up what went wrong in that result last night for the Canucks?
Yeah, to me, it just looked like a team that has run out of juice, right? And I know Quinn Hughes, I thought the quote from him post-game last night was tremendous, maybe the best clip he's given us all year when he talked about, you know, the St. Louis Blues aren't worrying about playing game sevens every other night. They've won 10 in a row. But I think what we saw last night was a team that has, you know, worn through this stretch. And that showed, I think, in their performance. Not that they didn't try, not that the effort wasn't there, but, you know, I'm sure it's incredibly tough, especially coming off a long road trip like that where you liked a lot of the things that you did. You played some good hockey, and the results go against you at a time of the year where you can't afford to have the results go against you. And, you know, ultimately it all came to a head with that loss last night against the Kraken. But I'm not reading into anything about, you know, this team quitting on the season. And I thought Marcus Pettersson was pretty defiant when sort of questioned about where the mentality sits and said, we're going to fight, you know, right to the final game if we have to. And that's the mentality they want to have. But this has been a long year for everyone, you know, not just in that dressing room, but around the organization in terms of all the injuries, all the drama, the change in personnel, right? Like we were talking off air in the booth last night about how this is the same season where Daniel Sprong started as a top
yes.
six forward on this team, right? So a lot has happened this year, and, you know, you would be only human if that didn't affect you to a certain extent. And so, you know, whether that's reading too much into one game, I'm not sure, but I thought that they just didn't have enough juice last night. And ultimately at this time of the year, that's going to make the difference.
What did you think of the Kraken speed and how it played against this Canucks lineup without Pettersson and Hedl in it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Canucks have struggled against teams with speed that attack off the rush all season long. And it's borne out in the season series against a Seattle team that, let's be honest, they're not a great team. They're already mathematically eliminated from the playoffs. Going into the game yesterday, they had about a 9.5% chance of drafting first overall, I think I saw in our game notes. So,
well, that would be big, like, for them.
Yeah, exactly.
They need that desperately, man.
No kidding. And even like the few trades that they made at the deadline, you know, not having guys like Bjorkstrand and Gord and Tanev, really sort of has changed their outlook. Although I do like a lot of their young pieces, and I think that is, you know, something that would be encouraging for Kraken fans, is like the development of a guy like Ryker Evans.
Yeah, Shane Wright.
You know, I thought Ty Cartier had some good moments in the game last night too. He's a guy with some upside there. Ryan Winterton got into the lineup. So, you know, stylistically though, I think the way that Seattle has played and the ability they have with some of the players at the top of their lineup to really make you hurt in transition is like the exact kind of team that the Canucks struggle against. And, you know, let's look at your favorite team, Drantz, or the Utah Hockey Club. They
yep.
profile very similarly, although their upside is much higher than Seattle's with the young talent that they have. And they also kind of cleaned up against the Canucks in the season series. So that's something I think when this organization heads into the off season that they will have to address, not just trying to find a way to be a quicker team, but be able to defend effectively against teams that play that kind of style. Because, you know, on a lot of nights this year, when the Canucks played teams like that, they came out on the wrong end of it.
So LA would meet that, would be a team that matches that description. Colorado would be a team that matches that description, Batch. St. Louis, Utah, Anaheim, Seattle. So that's a lot of Western Conference foes. I mean, how much of this was just like, hey, it looks different without Pettersson and Hedl? And how much of this is forward speed has to be one of the most critical needs that this team addresses this offseason?
Yeah, it's both, because, you know, when you know, you've got an AHL centerman who, you know, credit to him, Aturatu has played very well, but he's not a burner necessarily.
No, but either. I'm calling him an NHL centerman now, Batch. I'm convinced, even if yesterday was bit of a, like, you know, bounce back to a more pedestrian level game for him.
No, I agree, but I'm saying to this point in his career,
fair.
An AHL center, right? So, like, not a proven NHL guy. Is essentially your second-line center. That's going to hurt you. Hugh Suter is a guy who has had a tremendous year but would not be ideally cast as a number one center, is playing in that role. Like, eventually you're going to get found out when you have those sorts of injuries.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is a team that needs speed on the wings, too. It's not about all down the middle, and it's probably part of the reason why Brock Besser might be trending towards leaving, is because as much as he has a lot of very good things about his game, his scoring ability, his hockey IQ, he's not a burner. And you just listed, like, what, half of the Western Conference in terms of teams that play that style of game. So if you don't remodel this team in the image of some of those clubs that you're going to have to try and beat, and teams on the up like the Utah Hockey Club, who are going to be a much more realistic threat to take a potential playoff spot away from one of the teams that made it next year as opposed to this year. And no, that's not me.
No, I know. I'm just kidding.
This year, this is me saying that they're going to be that much better next year with all those young pieces and another summer for Ryan Smith to invest in the team with the salary cap going up. So, like, this is going to be a very competitive Western Conference going forward. And not only are these teams going to be competitive, they are going to be fast and they are going to be ruthless. And you have to be a team that can at least withstand that, if not attack that way yourself. And so, yeah, you know, missing a couple of guys that can play that way when they're at their best in Pettersson and Hedl down the middle, and just the general lack of that type of identity for this organization makes me look and say, okay, you know, they might have fared better if they had those guys in the lineup. But ultimately, they're not a team that's built to play that way, and that needs to change for them to have success going forward.
What do you make of goalie Pullgate?
It is like the most Vancouver thing ever. Like, oh, the one game he didn't pull the goalie, so we criticize him, and now he does pull the goalie, and we criticize him. Like, you know, I don't know. I mean, at this point in the season, I think it's much ado about nothing. When your season is on the line, when your head coach has said that last night was a game seven, you could have been down 20 goals. I still would have been okay with him pulling the goalie. Just because, you know, even if the team didn't necessarily have that desperation in their game, that's the message you need to convey to your players is, look, this is still important. I don't care if the odds are, you know, stacked heavily against us. And ultimately, at the end of the day, did it matter if they lost 4-0 or 5-0 last night? Like, it makes no difference. So it's one of those talking points that is unique to this market, or to markets that have a lot of focus on the team, where in, like, I don't know, 25 plus places in the NHL, that's not a question that would have even been asked after the game. And part of that is what makes Vancouver great, and why when things are going well in this market, people love to play for this team and they're a whole lot of fun to cover. But in seasons like this, like, I don't want to sit here and talk about should Rick Tocchet have pulled the goalie or not when they were down 4-0. Like, honestly, who cares? What difference does it make?
So, look, I don't want to go congressional hearing mode, Batch.
What?
But what did you... honestly, we have to have something on this program, and I just figured this is the best way to do it because we fundamentally agree. I think this is a preposterous story. But I do want to at least give our listeners a chance to vent and sort of hear the conversation. How do you sort of make sense, though, of the club, how the club handled it? Like, do you think in Winnipeg it was just a matter of after they jumped on their first 6-on-5, they weren't going to go back to pulling the goalie shorthanded? Was that like one of those didn't earn it non-pulls?
Yeah, maybe. Well, that's the interesting thing is that they were shorthanded, right? So at that point, you're pulling the goalie to get to 5-on-5. You're down by a couple. Like, you know, I can see it from the perspective of like, this doesn't actually give us any advantage at this point. We're just getting back to a level situation with the Jets, but then you don't have the goalie in. But like, I'll be honest, my reaction was I thought he should have pulled him in Winnipeg as well. But ultimately, do we think the Canucks were storming back at 5-on-5 with their goaltender out to tie that game against the best team in the league? Probably not. So like theoretically, I think there is an interesting question to be asked about Rick Tocchet's philosophy when it comes to pulling goaltenders, if for no other reason than it can be informative in terms of what to expect from him going forward. And maybe, you know, this is a situation where he learned, whether that was from outside noise criticizing it or whether there were internal conversations with the coaching staff about whether they should have pulled the goaltender or not. Like, you know, ultimately coaches are allowed to change their opinions and philosophies on things. And maybe he looked back at that afterwards and went, you know, maybe I should have pulled the goalie. And then, you know, he gets an opportunity in the very next game, albeit in quite different circumstances, to do it again. This has also been a team that scored a lot of 6-on-5 goals this year. So, you know, looking forward, he might have said, well, we've had success at that. If we get one, can we create a spark, or at least, as he alluded to post game, get some reps in case we have to do it the rest of the way this year. But, you know, ultimately they do contrast each other. I agree. I'm just not willing to sit here and read too much into it, I don't think.
My biggest takeaway from Tocchet pulling the goalie yesterday was he must be a People Show listener, because I know Bick was all over it on Monday after the Jets game. So I texted Bick right away and was like, Tocchet heard you, man. He agrees.
Well, I thought the most revealing part of Tocchet's answer, and it was the part that he started to go down that road and then pivoted, was where he talked about finding out which guys were, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something to the extent of finding out which guys are willing to play desperate hockey and which guys aren't.
Who's all in, basically. Then, yeah, I forget the exact wording as well, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, but something along those lines, like who's pulling on the rope and who isn't. And that, to me, is the most revealing part, because let's be perfectly honest, regardless of what the players in that dressing room will tell us in interviews about, you know, until we're mathematically eliminated, we're going to battle. And I do believe they're going to play their hearts out the rest of the way this season. But they know, right? The writing's on the wall. We all see the math. We all see the scenario. And Rick Tocchet sees it as well. And in moments like this, you can learn a lot about the character of your team and the character of your players that can help inform some of the decisions you're going to make in the off season. Now, are you going to make a sweeping conclusion about a player if he didn't have that desperation in a 4-0 deficit in the third period when you pulled the goalie against Seattle in a game that likely wasn't going to mean a whole lot anyway? Probably not, but you know, you will have been developing conclusions and analyzing players and seeing how they respond in situations throughout the year. And that was another opportunity for him to say, okay, you know, which guys are with us and which guys aren't. And, you know, although he only sort of subtly alluded to that before pivoting away from it, I think that was a very real consideration, I would imagine, because there are a lot of decisions to be made, especially with the forward group on this roster, in terms of how they want to move forward, trying to remodel themselves as a team, as we already alluded to, that can play better against teams that have speed and can attack off the rush, and then maybe can style their own offense in that regard as well.
So season not quite over here, obviously 7 more games on the schedule. As you said, the team's going to still compete hard, play, certainly, you know, play their guys until they're mathematically eliminated. But we also all see the direction this is going. We see the writing on the wall. So just starting to look back a little bit on the season as a whole, what do you think is going to be the kind of number one thing you remember, the thing that defines this season for you when you look back on it, Badge?
Oh, that's tough because there's so many things yep. that happened this year, right? Like, the easy answer would be everything went right last year, everything went wrong this year. And that is sort of like a big catch-all description for all of the drama, all of the injuries, all of the blown leads, all of the situations where they couldn't close games out, all of the overtime losses, which certainly made a big difference. So, like, that's sort of like the big sweeping, analysis that I would give on this year is, you know, we go back to that Jim Rutherford comment from 2 years ago about everything going right to be a playoff team. Well, everything went wrong this year, and as a result, they weren't a playoff team. But I also think that the way we look back on this season is going to be defined more by what happens next than by what has already happened. So, you know, let's say Elias Pettersson gets back to his game, remains a Vancouver Canuck long-term, plays to the level of his contract, and things go well for him, and Quinn Hughes stays and signs an extension, then this could be seen as the year that needed to happen to have the changes that needed to happen to allow those guys to really take off as the leaders and the core parts of this group, and ultimately the biggest defining point of that would be moving on from JT Miller. Conversely, you know, that's like a best case scenario. So let's go to the other end of the spectrum and say maybe the Canucks move on from Pettersson, or he struggles to find his game and ultimately doesn't work for him in Vancouver. Maybe things go the wrong direction with Hughes. We don't know how that conversation is going to go, and I don't want to speculate in too much detail about what that might look like going forward. But this season, I think, will be seen as a turning point one way or the other. Either the year that needed to happen where you broke a few eggs, but it allowed you to make the omelet going forward, or the year where everything fell apart for this core group. And it will be the year that could define this core group if ultimately the guys that remain can't move on and have success in Vancouver and have success with this organization. So, you know, a lot of stuff happened. There were a lot of difficult things this team had to go through. And I think the question is going forward, will they be better for the experience, or will it be sort of the beginning of the end for this group of players and this era of Canucks hockey?
I like the idea of how we will define this season, Batch. Like that appeals to me. Should we draft? Should we draft? Should we go around and all suggest like monikers, like, you know, the Bruce There It Is season. You all know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
right? The season they all got COVID, the bubble season, right? Like yeah. we have all these yeah. sort of, like, you know, last year we'll probably just remember as like the playoff season or
the good season.
yeah. The PDO season.
The
I don't
PDO
know.
Season,
like
yeah.
There's lots of different ways to remember it. So, what do you want to,
can I go first?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the Rift.
The Rift.
Or it'll Ooh. Be like the PDJT year. Remember the PDJT year?
I like the Rift season.
Yeah.
I think that's good. The Rift season, that's going to be the winner, right?
That's going to be what really, like, in not just this summer, how we're talking about it, but in like 10 years, whoever's doing our job then is going to be like, remember the Rift season? Like, that was so weird. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The same way we look back at like the Torts year, you know? Like, oh, remember the Torts year, right? That's how people are going to be talking about it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I almost think there's no point in doing a draft because there's
that's
like
the
nothing unless you've got something that comes close to it, Dranser. Like this is how this season will be defined. And as I said, ultimately, the context within the definition of this season is important, right? Like, is that the rift that needed to happen, the parting of the ways that needed to happen for this group to move forward, or was it a precursor of things to come? And that's not just going to be within the context of Elias Pettersson and his relationship with JT Miller, but it's going to be within the context of the greater group and what they can do going forward. And I think within the context of Rick Tocchet and his future in Vancouver as well, because obviously he was the guy answering questions about all that stuff on a daily basis and the coach that was trying to keep things on the rails when they were going off it through November and December. So yeah, ultimately the rift is going to define this season, but whether that ends up being a good thing, like ripping off a Band-Aid, or whether it isn't, is the fascinating thing that we'll get to analyze going forward, and ultimately how the context will be surrounding this season.
Yeah, is it the beginning of the end of an era, or is it you know, a bump on the way to whatever this team becomes in sort of what we'll probably remember as like the Quinn Hughes era or the Hughes-Pettersson era, or, you know, depending on who else can match Quinn Hughes's level going forward here. Not many people, by the way, on the entire planet. Batch, 4 regulation wins in 14 games since the trade deadline. Do we look at do we look at the club's inactivity at the deadline any differently as a result of what we've seen in the, you know, 25 days since?
Well, I think ultimately there will be fair criticism that this club didn't move off some of the pieces that they could have, especially if those pieces don't return. And ultimately, there is still the opportunity for them to extend Brock Besser. They could still look at extending Pugh Suter. So, you know, that will all depend on the decisions they make going forward. That said, you know, the criticism they may receive should not impact their decision-making. Like, if they've already made the decision that Pugh Suter's contract is going to be too expensive, they shouldn't pivot now just because they'll be criticized for not getting a draft pick for him at the deadline. But, I mean, it's so tough because I can understand it from their perspective of setting a firm price for a player as good as Besser and saying, you know, we're not just going to move on from this guy for nothing because, you know, he ultimately did score some important goals for this team when they were still in the playoff fight. You look at that tying goal in St. Louis that allowed them to get a point right at the start of the road trip. He got on a pretty good little heater there for a while. That was why they kept him. They wanted their playoff hopes to continue, and they felt that he would be a big game player, and he has proven to be a big game player and scored some clutch goals in his time. But you know, this feels like a cop-out answer again, but the way we look back on this trade deadline is going to be within the context of how does the off season go? Are they able to bolster this roster? Do they extend those guys or not? And ultimately, do they get back to being a more competitive team next year? Or again, is this sort of like a precursor of what's to come? And, you know, if this is a team that trends in the wrong direction, like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Drancer, because you would have a better memory for this or not, but the organization under a different management group received a lot of criticism for the way they handled Dan Hamhuis at the trade deadline. And because that team then went on to continue to struggle in subsequent years, that criticism sort of continued to pile on because they were essentially going through a tank-type rebuild unintentionally, and those were assets they could have really used that they didn't have the opportunity to get because they didn't move on from Dan Hamhuis. And, like, I wasn't in this job at that time, so I'm sort of a bit more blurry on the details than you might be.
No, you're right.
So that to me, like,
this,
like
very fair.
This deadline might look like that deadline if this team continues to struggle, whereas people will be more willing to forget and move on if they can get back to being a competitive team. Like, nobody last season was talking about them giving up futures for bringing in Lindholm and Zadorov, and those conversations are only really starting to happen now because you're looking at a team that's going to miss the playoffs and saying, oh, those future pieces would be really nice to help bolster what they want to do this summer. So,
yeah. There was some conversation about how it would have been nice if they're giving up a first-round pick to have gotten, like, a long-term fit as opposed to a rental in Lindholm. But, you know, that was, like, very much day of the trade. Like, put it this way. No one mentioned a single time in this market that Bo Horvat had 33 goals and 68 points last season.
No, exactly.
No one cared at all.
Well, and I think, like, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, I remember a conversation we had on this show last year where we were talking about they need to do more. Like, their window may be so short. They have a competitive team this year. Like, they should be pushing all of their chips in to get as many complimentary pieces as possible because this might be the best opportunity in this window for this team to have success. And ultimately, I think none of us had any idea how right we might have been based on how poorly this season went in comparison. And we'll see what happens going forward with this group. But, you know, context is so important. So, you know, yes, could that trade deadline be something that we talk about for years in Vancouver in a negative light if things go the wrong direction? for this team going forward. Yeah, I think that is certainly possible. At the same time, I think it'll be a blip on the radar of what this team does if the management group has a successful summer, and this time next year we're talking about a team that's playing playoff hockey.
One suggestion for a defining name of the season in the inbox, by the way, the year they traded Daniel Sprong.
we'll always remember that goal he scored.
He scored the first goal of the season.
And that sick one in Abbotsford in the preseason.
That's true. Yeah, wow, that was a big deal.
Yeah. You see, we'll never forget that.
Never forget it.
That is one of those goals that like makes the plays of the year countdown on Sportsnet.
Yeah. It was an unbelievable goal.
Like, that was the nicest goal that I've maybe ever called in an NHL game. So I will remember Daniel Sprong for that specifically.
Fantastic. Batch, always appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much. We'll chat soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, boys. Have a good one.
That is Brendan Batchelor. He's the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650. We'll take a break. We'll dive into the inbox next. Open segments coming up here for the final hour of the show. So get your texts in, 650-650, and we'll read some of them on the other side here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we got a lot of thoughts coming in about last night, about what's next, the remainder of the season even. And one thing that I think caught a lot of people's attention that we haven't really had a chance to check in on or dig into, I should say, is the coach. And major topic of conversation, of course. But this text comes in. Do you guys think Tockett is just mentally checked out now? That post-game interview really was something. I don't think Tockett is mentally checked out. I think he is probably exhausted and extremely frustrated. And I think that came through in his post-game press conference last night. And I think there's a lot of different things you could pick from that post-game comments to kind of illustrate that point. I mean, I know the guys on the morning show were talking about the poise thing. It's just hammering at home, poise, 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 poise. I don't think his answer about the goalie poll was super straightforward or clear. It just seemed very, very frustrated. And I understand that. So I don't think it's like, just like we were saying, well, look, the players didn't play well, but I don't think it was like they gave up or they quit. I don't think Tockett's quit on the team or mentally checked out by any stretch.
Mad.
I think he's just super frustrated with how this has played out and probably with his team, to be quite frank. Like, I think he's frustrated with more than that as well, but there's a lot for him to be upset about. And I think that came through in a big way last night when he was talking to the media.
Yeah, I just think this is a super competitive guy grappling with the reality of his team situation. The fact that for all the hard work and all the grind that, you know, that he's brought throughout the season, all the sacrifices in terms of time and, you know, on and on, that they're going to fall short. And I think that's really hard to process in 25 minutes before you have to go face the media. You know, and I just think it was genuine and authentic, and I think he was just really, really bad.
Yeah. What did you make?
And we have to allow space for that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Especially because, like...
Well, and it's not like he lashed out or anything. You know what I mean? Like, he kept his composure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No. Like, it's... He was just a little...
It wasn't unprofessional or anything.
No. He was just a little scattered. He just wasn't the way... He wasn't as clear as he usually is, and I think it was just genuine disappointment. There's got to be space for that. You've got to be allowed to be a human being.
Oh, 100%.
You know, we're not always, especially when we're processing disappointment, we're not always at our absolute tippy-top best. I just think he wasn't in that moment relative to, like, the clarity of communication that he usually brings.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Tockett's pretty good at this, generally, I think. I think his approach to the Vancouver media and the media game and his media obligations has generally been really solid. Like a standout trait, something he's excelled at. And, you know, I just think last night he was a little frustrated. And how could you not be?
Or a lot frustrated.
Or very deeply frustrated. Yeah.
Very understandably so. What did you think of his emphasis on the poise thing, right? And, you know, specifically talking about, well, I thought it was also notable because he started saying, like, some guys were nervous out there, which is, like, I get it, it's theoretically a big game, but you're also home against Seattle, and in a way, you should be playing almost loose because, like, what have you got to lose at that point, right? So I did think that was interesting, but the focus on poise and, you know, got to hit the net. You know, we had so many missed shot opportunity or shot opportunities that go wide or miss the net. When we do hit the net, we got to be putting in a better position on the goalie, trying to get a rebound. I think he's absolutely right. Like, you can't be wasteful with your opportunities. I do think sometimes when fans are assessing what a team's doing offensively and what's going wrong for a team, it's really easy to focus in on, like, oh, they missed the net. And I think a lot of time that's a red herring where, you know, instead of focusing on missing the net or hitting the net, you should be trying to get into better positions and more often that where you're going to have a better chance to beat the goalie. So I did, like, I found that kind of not odd, but maybe just a little concerning. And, you know, obviously I've been pretty supportive of what Rick Tocchet has done for this team this year in the face of a lot of criticism he's taken. And I still think that's the case, but I do wonder, like, that struck me again as a coach who's kind of at the end of his rope on the season where it's like, okay, this is something I know is really important. So I'm going to hammer it over and over and over again because things just aren't working. And it's almost like retreating a little bit to the thing you're most comfortable with. And to me, it's just like, yeah, you got to hit the net. You got to hit the net. You got to be better with your chances. But I also don't think that's close to the number one issue of why the Canucks are have struggled to score so often this year.
So, yeah, I mean, so you're expressing your frustration with shot location here, right?
No, it's my frustration with the hyper fixation on it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I get it. Look, it was top of mind for him last night, whatever. So that's what he was focused on. That's fine. I just have trouble watching the Canucks and thinking, like, man, if they just took their opportunities more, they'd be a dangerous team. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, that doesn't match what I'm seeing.
They're an above average finishing team.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just true.
So I don't, like, it's like, well, okay, maybe poise was an issue last night, but is that, well, a major thing we're seeing with the Canucks consistently?
I mean, I do think that this team, the logic of this team, given that they're not like a high volume scoring chance or shot generation team, like they do rely on efficiency. And I think for the most part, it's the strength of the team. I watch a lot of teams that are far more wasteful with scoring chances than the Canucks are. Just like as a general rule, I think the Canucks are pretty good about, keeping it simple, shooting through traffic. I think you see regularly that, like, the Blues game for me is the perfect example where, like, the Blues dominated play and had all these ornate sort of chances at chances that they were squandering.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's like Sherwood, far side through traffic. Besser just under the circle from almost the exact same spot, far side on Binnington through traffic, right? The last shot's a little different because that's a 6-on-5 situation, and Besser kind of had no other option. It was just like hammer it as hard as I can short side, and it was sick, right? But the contrast to me was massive in that game where, you know, I think the Blues are a well-coached team. Maybe there's a level to which you have to be too fancy in the league right now,
yeah,
given how difficult it is to score goals. But, well, it's actually less difficult than it used to be, but the relative to, you know, how many chances or shots it takes. But, maybe there's an edge in sort of playing the way the Blues do versus the way Vancouver does. If that's your argument, I'm here for it. But I do think, like, we've seen it a lot, and we've seen it a lot in OT. It's been sort of part of the storyline there, in my opinion. But we've seen a lot of times where, you know, 2-on-1, force the pass when you could just shoot it low and hard, right far side on the goaltender. We've seen this team miss far side a lot, which isn't just a miss. It's also like you're clearing the puck for your opponent.
And Tocchet specifically referenced that last night. And yeah. I want to be clear, that drives me nuts too. So I'm 100% on board with him being like, guys, can we stop doing that? Can we stop feeding the other team's breakout and their rush chances with our missed shots? Like, no issue here whatsoever with that being a point of emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, I think the truth is that the way that this Canucks team has to win is by having that tactical noose. You know, like the fourth goal that Seattle scores comes off Derek Forbert trying to slot line pass into the slot, you know, from beneath the goal line. Well, you know, I get it. You're down 3-0 and you're playing for your playoff lives, but that is going to create a goal. Like, that's tough when you combine that with like the DeBrusk turnover and some of the ways that the Canucks manage the game. Like, they weren't sharp the way they need to be to win. When this team, like last year, is at their best, they seem smarter about winning games than their opponents. And I think part of that is, you know, Tocchet's hyperfixation on shot selection and how they attack and how they want to play. Yeah. The like predictability and structure,
you might call it, right? Like,
you saw it against Columbus, for example, right? Like, it was very clear very early in that game that the Canucks were too cagey for the Blue Jackets. They lost anyway, in part because of goaltending and because the Blue Jackets hit this high gear. But, you know, Canucks are sort of on them early. They're sort of adding mistakes, piling mistakes one on top of the other. You get the Matejczyk delay of game. Like, I texted you about it. I was like, I don't even think you were watching. You were like out at dinner and you just got a text from me that was like, the Canucks are too cagey for the Blue Jackets. And then in seconds it was 3-0. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you see that a lot. I thought you saw that against the Devils, the Islanders. Like, there's a lot of games this year where I feel like the Canucks are getting away with it in part because they are better at avoiding mistakes than a lot of their opponents.
And they take their opportunities and they're good. But I guess that's kind of my point, is like, they are good at taking their opportunities so often.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So it's like, to me, it's not so much if you're already good at taking your opportunities. Like, I get you want to preserve your edge. You want to maintain your edge. And if that's part of your identity and that's part of your style, that's fine. Like, we've seen it can have success. But it's also fundamentally, I think, going to have diminishing returns if that is what you are hyper-focused on. Like, to me, the goal should be, and look, it's late in the season, there's 7 games left, this is more of a start of the season thing, the goal should be increasing the volume of chances that you can be super effective in, right?
Yeah,
like, that you can be clinical on. And I guess it's more of a criticism of Tocchet. To me, it was just kind of symptomatic of where the team is and how frustrating this moment is, because I think it's very natural to laser focus in on some of that bedrock stuff at this time of year, even if I think you kind of end up missing the forest for the trees in the process. You know what I mean? Like, it kind of reminds me of like a baseball team where the announcers are like, oh man, they got to do a better job at moving the runners over with outs. You know what I mean? It's like, well, that's true, that would help. But also, they need to get on base more and they need to hit more home runs. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what my reaction is when I hear that, like, oh, the Canucks need to hit the net more. Sure. Yeah, and they'll shoot for rebounds more. That's absolutely true. You also just need to be generating so much more.
Yeah.
And then do that other stuff on top of it.
Yeah, and look, they do have to be generating more. They also have to get back to being as locked down defensively as they were last season, because there was real slippage in that part of their game over the course of this year. You know, certainly I think their goaltending in the second half wasn't as good as it was in the first half. I think Lankinen, you know, was probably ran out of steam a little bit, was probably overextended, especially given the emotional starts that he made during the Four Nations. And then, you know, Demko, when he's been in, has been uneven. Like, what, the Canucks have... the Canucks are not winning a ton of games with him in the net.
Nope.
I know there have been moments where it's been easy to get excited again.
His last chunk of games going into last night
was
had been
really,
really
good,
really strong,
for sure. But on
and then he wasn't good last night.
Yeah, and we all understand the context of it, right? But the truth is that Demko's made and finished 19 games over the course of the season, and the team has 19 points in those games. Like, they're 500 point percentage team in Thatcher Demko's starts, right? They're significantly worse than that. I think they have 4 points or 5 points in Artur Shelov's 9 starts, 2-6-1. Right. So, like, that's how much of the burden has been on Kevin Lankinen. Right. I bet the club's pretty close to 100-point percentage in just Lankanen starts this season.
Mm.
So, you know, goaltending's been something of an issue, frankly, over the course of this year, especially, you know, the team's performance from a record perspective in games where their most utilized goaltender, Lankanen, was their starter this season, didn't get the start yet. 24, 14, and 9 in Lankanen's... So that's pretty good, man. That's like a 56 points out of an available 90. Like that's you get that over the course of the year. Yeah, that's 104 point. They were on 104 point pace in Lankanen starts. So that was a big part of the story here, is between Demko not being Demko right away when he returned, and then having the occasional blip like last night, and Shelov's unplayability except against the Chicago Blackhawks. Like Vancouver's record in games without their starter killed them this year.
Yeah.
Killed them. Flat out killed them.
Yeah.
Right? You get 500 or better goaltending in the non-Lankanen games, you're very much in the mix with St. Louis and Minnesota right now.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a lot of little things that went wrong. The offense, the goaltending,
the defense for a lot of the year.
It's honestly...
dang it. The special teams, for at least on the power play.
Yeah, I mean, the special teams rounded into form, but the power play is still frustrating.
The culture, there's just a lot of little things that went wrong here this year.
I think the truth is that everything that could have gone wrong for the Canucks felt like it did.
Yeah.
And when you really run through the list... You know, from Popliteus to...
Well, I don't disagree, except I will say, and I know he's missed time and he's run out of gas now. Like, everything did go wrong, except Quinn Hughes got even better than his Norris Trophy campaign. So it's not like, yes, a lot of things went wrong, but also one really, really big thing went right.
Right.
Like, I do think that's an important thing
to
remember.
But then you get the tough visual of last night where it's like Atlas is finally like, I'm tired.
I just want to push back a little bit against the like, well, how could they possibly have succeeded in these circumstances? Yeah, like, I don't think it's entirely unfair, but it's just like, well, how could you have possibly succeeded with the best defenseman in the world? I can think of some ways.
Well, but even like, okay, yes, Hughes ascended to another plane. Okay. And then... I'm not exactly sure what injury he sustained with his hand.
Sure.
But he spent 2 months
playing games
with a Wolverine claw.
Wow, that sounds awesome. So you got even better, you mean?
And then he injured reportedly his oblique and then sustained compensation injuries while trying to come back from it, to the point where he's standing on the bench between shifts stretching constantly.
Yeah. It's tough to watch.
So as much as Quinn Hughes has been like, you know, Neo from the Matrix, and it feels like he can see the code, you know, it hasn't been a perfect run out for that dude.
No, you're right.
Pettersson.
Well, I mean.
I'm just saying, like, I still don't know how to talk about that. I don't know I don't know what's going on.
No one does.
I know. So you have... basically an unprecedented fall off from a 26-year-old superstar center you're paying in the first year of his new contract, a rift between that player and another 100-point center that causes you to have to trade that player after they take an unexplained 10-game absence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And explicitly from management's mouth, cannot coexist anymore in the same locker room as one of your other star players, both of whom you've extended within the last 18 months. You have a newly extended power forward coming off of a career year whose summer training is interrupted by a testicular cancer diagnosis and surgery to fix it. You lose Derek Forbert for multiple weeks because of a death in his family.
Mm-hmm.
Thatcher Demko has an unprecedented popliteus tear, reportedly, followed up by a lower back injury absence and then another lower body absence that costs him 6 weeks. So your Vezina caliber starter only plays 20 games and is like deeply inconsistent across those 20 games. You lose Hronek for 6 weeks. Pettersson just gets
Besser's out of the lineup for a concussion.
With a bad concussion, yeah. Off a brutal hit. Pettersson just gets going right before Christmas, and then he leaves that game injured and loses a stretch of games there. I mean, it's pretty shocking.
It is. It is.
When you really go over the timeline, and Jamie, they traded Daniel Sprong.
And they traded Daniel Sprong.
So I think when you
and
go...
And the Danton Heinen signing didn't work out.
Didn't come close to working.
Throw it on the pile.
And we had watched a lot of Vinny Deharnay.
Boy, did we.
We learned some... I'll be honest with you. On the list of things that sunk this Canucks season, Vinny Deharnay and Eric Brandstrom do not register. They were totally fine as a third pair. I'll go to my grave being like, that worked. I don't know what else to tell everybody. It wasn't good, but it worked.
Yeah.
It was fine. In fact, this team's best stretch of hockey all season was played with those guys as like a fixture on the third pair. Let's be real. Like that stretch in October and November where they finally got going in eight against an easy schedule. So I think when you look at all the stuff that didn't work for this team and some of the stuff that's like pretty marginal, like we don't expect a team to lose like this in OT the way the Canucks did, even if part of the issue was personnel based on the back end, right? Like even if the real issue more than anything else was that, especially while Hronek was out of the lineup, the Canucks really only had one defender you wanted to trust playing 3-on-3.
Yeah.
And that is a huge, like, that's the lion's share of the story. It wasn't all bad luck or random distribution. A team was only outscored by one with Quinn Hughes on the ice 3-on-3, right? Like, that's fine. If you were 500 in overtime this year, you'd be fine.
Yep.
Again, you'd be in the mix with
you'd
Minnesota
be right
and
there.
St. Louis.
Yep.
So that didn't happen. The backup goaltending points left on the board, massive for this team. And then the rush of injuries, the inability to get going. You know, the fact that most of their unrestricted free agent signings didn't work. Like, DeBrusk was good. I think he met expectations. I wouldn't say he exceeded them. Met.
DeBrusk, I think, he was the number one free agent signing for the Canucks. Fairly significant, right? Like, it's not like it was like Carson Soucy was the year before, right? But it was by default because they barely signed anyone.
Yeah.
Like, that's a pretty significant in the spotlight position, usually, right? Like, hey, this is the guy we signed to the longest term and the most money as an unrestricted free agent. I don't think a guy in that position has ever been, like, less a focus of the season. And that's not a criticism, by the way, of Jake DeBrusk.
I would say Louis Erickson.
No, Louis Erickson was a massive focus.
The thing is, though, is, like, his disappointment was registered, but he was just such a ghost. He was never around. We never heard
from him. No. But, like, as a talking point, it was dominant. Like, oh, my gosh, we're paying this guy $6 million. We first had this how many more. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, Jake DeBrusk, and again, because it's not criticism.
He scored in his own net.
It's just, like, he's been exactly Jake DeBrusk.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, how could you have a hot take on the signing? You know what I mean? Like, no one's going to be like, this is a home run. No one's going to be like, this is a disaster.
He's going to finish at 25 goals and 50 points.
And then he's been like the 18th most interesting thing on the team because there's been all this other crazy stuff happening. So it's just like, Jake DeBrusk is a Canuck now, I guess.
So Sherwood hit.
Sherwood's a hit, yeah.
And the rest of them were like Heinen didn't work. Deharnay didn't work. Sprong didn't work. There's a lot of compelling reasons to believe that this team is better than their record when you actually sort through it, right? Like fixing your backup goaltending, whether that's, you know, with Demko just improving health-wise or the club doing something else, like that's not something that's can't be fixed in an offseason, right? Fixing your overtime record, especially with like Volander and like Elias Pettersson.
With your completely different defense core now.
Elias Pettersson can play in 3-on-3. Marcus Pettersson can play in 3-on-3. Like Quinn Hughes shouldn't be playing 4 minutes in 3-on-3 situations anymore. You have actual speedy options. Derek Forbert, offensive driver. Let's go. So like there's a lot of just like lost change on the margins that, you know, you don't look at and think reflects who this team is. I think that's the bull case, in addition to, of course, the nuclear bomb that this team has in their arsenal. Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break here. Still lots to get into on the other side. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we can start maybe looking ahead a little bit as well with some of your thoughts coming in. We'll do that next here in the final segment of the show on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz.
Canucks Talk.
What's that?
I don't know. It was like a weird Nordic voice to go with the music.
I did not pick up on the Nordicness of it.
Yeah, like I was trying to do like the real McCoy, like in your dreams of love so true. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure. All right. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in Step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Now, just before we go back into the inbox, I did want to pass this along from Frank Saravalli and Daily Faceoff. They just published their... as he calls it, the top 50 UFAs, so the kind of UFA big board at Daily Faceoff. And just interesting because the way they do it is they take salary and contract projections from, I believe it's AFP analytics. So they're kind of ranking people, not just based on like subjective interest is going to be in the player around the league, but what this projection system thinks they're going to get. So the kind of total money that they think these players are going to be able to land on the open market, or at least that's part of it. And Mitch Marner, number one, don't think a big surprise there. AFP projects him 8-year, $12.6 million AAV.
Low.
Number two on the list, Brock Besser, projected for a 7-year, $9.1 million deal. And again, look.
Maybe a little high.
Probably a little high, but I do think there's an illustrative thing there that if you're doing a statistical model on what a guy's going to get paid, Brock Besser grades out very well. And I know we get hung up on the, well, he's only cracked 30 goals once. It's like, well, that's because a bunch of seasons have been disrupted for various reasons. Some due to his injury, some completely outside of his control, right? Otherwise, he'd have more 30-goal seasons on his resume. If you just get down to the brass tacks of what he's produced in his career, Brock Besser has a very, very strong, free agency case to be made on the open market. And I thought, like, I wasn't expecting him to be number two on this list, considering a couple of the other names that are going to be out there. But I think it's just a good data point that, you know, he's holding a pretty strong hand here as the season winds down and we get closer to July 1st.
Yeah. and you know, the truth is that this was all locked in. I mean, he played well after the deadline, but, you know, the moment you went past the deadline without monetizing Brock Besser, the leverage was going to shift to him anyway. And there'll be a narrative about, you know, what Patrick Alvin's post-deadline commentary meant for those contract talks. I think it's fair to bring up, at the very least.
Yep.
But I think the truth is that the leverage was always going to shift toward the player the closer they got to July 1. That's how often do we talk about this? Like, that's baked in. Pius Suter has scored a bunch, too, since the deadline. And likewise, people will be like, well, if he hits 25 goals, that's going to, you know, the ka-ching factor. It's like, guys, his leverage was always going to be enhanced the closer we got here. In fact, if anything, just not going to playoff teams, right? Not having the chance to show out with the eyes of the hockey world on your games, like, that's tough, especially if you're a guy, you know, especially if you're guys who do subtler things, right? Like, you watch Besser in one game, you might be like, well, he does a lot well, but I'm a little worried about his foot speed. But you watch him over the course of an entire playoff series and you have like a better understanding of how he compensates with just,
sure,
you know, his size, his battle winning, his playmaking, his overall hockey IQ. Likewise with Pius Suter. Pius Suter never makes a mistake and is just like, oh, wow, that slow small guy is always in the right spot. That's unbelievable, right? Like, You get to watch him over the course of an entire playoff series. Maybe he plays four different roles for a team over the course of it, too. And you really get an appreciation of who he is. And yet, I think the Canucks have to be really careful about returning anybody. You know, like, I'm Pius Suter's biggest fan, I think, other than, like, maybe his direct family.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, the talk of like, is he the answer at second line center? No. The answer is flat no. He's the perfect seventh top six forward for a contending team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's worth $4 million at that level.
As the kind of luxury finishing piece. Or not finishing piece, but like luxury supporting piece.
High end third liner.
Yeah.
who raises your floor absolutely everywhere, right? Like, ideally, I want him slotted on the left wing of my third line so that the moment I lose a top six forward of any stripe, center, right wing, left wing, he goes up and stabilizes my top six. He's Ben Zobrist. He's not, you know, Matsui or something.
Sure, yeah.
Like, he's the utility guy. He's the floor raiser. I'm happy to have that guy at $4 million if I'm a contending team, provided that I've slotted him correctly to where I can win with him at that level. It's not the contract value in my mind. It's the role.
Yeah. And I also think there's a similar discussion, honestly, to be had with Besser, where you have to wait. Like, how much can you afford to spend to lock up complementary players before you have the guys they're complementing in place? You know what I mean? And, like, Brock Besser is fundamentally a really, really good complementary player, a high-end complementary player. We've seen how well he does next to JT Miller. We all know that. Do you want to lock into Brock Besser before you have the guy that he's supposed to be the sidekick for? I think that's a difficult thing to do, especially, and we know this team is desperately in need of that kind of high-end talent to try to find a way to get it in the open market. I think, by the way, Jamie in Richmond texted in before you even said Ben Zobrist. Suter is the Ben Zobrist of hockey.
Oh, nice.
So he's on the same wavelength. I think that came in before.
I didn't rip you off, though, man.
No. That's not what I was accusing you of.
No, I know. I just want to.
Yeah. It was just like simultaneous.
Yeah.
Like, didn't multiple people come up with like penicillin at the same time or something? You know what I mean?
Really? No, that was.
I don't know.
Wasn't that Fleming? Anyway,
some example like that.
How dare you besmirch Fleming?
The suitor,
the top seven forward.
The other note from the takeaway, and again, this is not breaking new ground, but from the Daily Faceoff top 50 pending UFAs. So, okay, let's just look.
Do we know how accurate? Like, does
know.
That AFP?
It's just something. A lot of these are going to be very low.
But do they test it? Like at the end of the season, do they show it on a R squared scatter plot?
I can't tell you. So we'll see.
Need to show your work before I'll use it.
But the other point is, okay, so let's go forwards under the age of 30. You got Mitch Marner, Brock Besser,
Nikolai Ehlers,
Sam Bennett, Nick Ehlers. After those four, you go down to...
Tavares?
No, under 30.
Oh.
Ryan Donato, Jack Roslovic, Pugh Suter, Trent Frederick, Andrew Mangiapane.
Yeah, I like Mangiapane.
I like Mangiapane.
That's a good one.
Mason Appleton's 29.
Ooh.
There you go. He sneaks in there. Andre Kuzmenko. Justin Brazeau. Adam Gaudette.
Nope.
That's it. So those are on the top 50 forwards, UFA forwards under the age of 30.
Yeah, UFA is going to be, well, this
and
is.
And again, that's not, no one, this is not breaking news that it's slim pickings in that category on the UFA market, but it is helpful to kind of see it laid out like that and how quickly the quality and the interest level is going to drop off.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just need to understand that the unrestricted free agency will only go so far. And as we mentioned yesterday, right, it's not just that the talent is iffy, frankly. It's also that the
cost is going to be iffy.
Well, no, it's also that the Canucks don't have a ton of purchasing power.
Yeah.
They're not a top 10 team in terms of their amount of cap space. They've unwound like just how grim the cap situation was, but that doesn't mean relative to the league that they have oodles of cap space. And, you know, their cap positioning going into this offseason is further compromised by some of the ghosts of mistakes past. You know, they have a little bit of the Mikheyev retention on the books. I still think that Mikheyev trade was a home run given where this team was and what they needed, right? And sort of how inefficient that contract was. But there's a cost to doing business, to making that sort of a trade that the club made. And you've got the Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout cap hit accelerating massively year over year, right? Like, that's going to be a far more, you know, cumbersome hit going forward. Like, this team has kind of just missed. One of the benefits of buying out Oliver Ekman-Larsson when they did was that there were 2 years where the cap hit was like extremely modest. It was basically free to do year one when the Canucks went to the second round. And this year it was also essentially free. Well, there's going to be a $5 million hold base, $4.5 million hit, basically dead money hit for the next 2 years. So they're actually going to encounter like a top or middle six forward level roadblock in their cap spending. Then you sort of go down and it's like, okay, what assets do they have to trade? They actually have some pretty interesting young players now. Ratu, Elias Pettersson, Lekkerimäki, Volander. But are you willing to deal those, especially with some of the big picture uncertainty that looms around this team, both in terms of like Pettersson getting back on track, Quinn Hughes's extension eligibility in 15 months, Demko and Garland hitting their extension eligibility just this year? Do you have to safeguard your young guys, or are those chips that you can play on the trade market, right? If you don't have, you have cap space, but you don't have relative buying power, right? You have trade assets, but can you afford to part with them? Especially the younger ones. You have draft capital, but not a full compliment. A compliment?
A full compliment.
A full compliment.
A full compliment. A full accomplishment.
Sorry, I just wanted to call myself out on that malapropism. And, you know, so okay, great. Doing the Thomas Drantz checklist thing, we're kind of where we often are with this team. And that's, I think, what's difficult for fans to process now. It's like, okay, out of the playoffs, not close to picking in the top five, probably not picking in the top 10. We've been here too often. Like, this is where the Canucks have lived for far too long. And on top of it, the structure of it all, like bad free agency class and poor buying power, and massive needs for multiple top six forwards, and frankly, not enough asset weaponry, whether it's disposable trade chips or draft picks or whatever, to credibly pull it off. So how does this team get to where they want to go next season? Which, let's be real, is going to be an all-in off season. This team wants to get back to contention. How do they get there? They're going to have to pull a rabbit out of a hat.
And on that kind of big picture discussion, I wanted to read this text from Ramon, who says, "Hey, Drantz. I really enjoyed your article today. I'm curious, why do you seem to be the only one in the market taking a broader big picture view? Dodd, Bruff, and Halford seem fixated on just one player and rarely stray from that. They never touch on the prospect pool or the fact that this team doesn't seem to have a long-term vision. It's all about one player and nothing beyond that." So first of all, I didn't realize I had entered the Jason Bruff zone of monomaniacal focus on Elias Pettersson. First of all, no one is touching Bruff in that category. I am a rank amateur compared to Jason Bruff there in that category. But like, as you said, we're back at this point where we've been so often before. And I think you're right.
I think the truth is we never left.
But there is one key difference, which is if you had talked to me 2 years ago, we've been doing this checklist. It's like, well, they have Hughes and Pettersson, and they're, you know, at the time, what, 24 and 23. And Pettersson's coming off a 100-point season. Right? That's a lot different than just having Quinn Hughes. Those guys are 2 years older, and you have no idea what you're getting from Elias Pettersson. So yeah. I do focus a lot on it.
And he's real expensive now.
Yeah, and he's super expensive because
like he feels like a risky bet.
So much of that other stuff, the prospect pool, the draft capital, the cap flexibility, the strength of the free agent market, you know, your tradable assets, like that's the stuff you use to put the finishing pieces around the star players, around the studs at the top of your lineup who are going to carry you. So it still matters, but like in a way it also kind of doesn't matter if that version of Elias Pettersson is gone.
Right.
So
unless he's part of the chips that you
unless
use.
Unless he's part of the going out process. Yeah. So look, do we sometimes hyper-focus? Yeah, sure. On Elias Pettersson, of course. But like, I do think there's a logic there, which is that whatever level he settles at, ultimately, if this is it, or if he does get back to his previous level, or if he's no longer with the team because they don't think they can take that bet, like that matters just as much in a league, as you always say now, that is increasingly becoming dominated by star players, and it's becoming so important to have that star level talent at the top of your roster. You need to have that in place to make the other stuff count, to make the big picture vision stuff count, to make the prospect pool count and all of that. And look, the other thing I'll say to Ramon is, if you're wanting...
You're feeling real defensive, eh, buddy?
No. I just, like, I thought it was funny that I was lumped in with Bruff, especially because Bruff and I were texting about Pettersson specifically yesterday, so I was like, you might have a point there.
The hater's ball.
You might have a point there. I think we're going to be transitioning rapidly into, like, the big picture conversation here.
Oh, yeah,
I don't mean on our show, I mean everywhere in the market. Somebody else texted in Jamie Andrancher, do you think this management group is ready for the amount of criticism that's going to be leveled at them by fans after this year? The tone around this team has shifted back to the late Benning years. I wouldn't say it's gone quite that far, but people are pretty frustrated.
People should be frustrated, but I don't think that this management group deserves the same level of criticism as the late era Benning Canucks did. And I'd add this, I don't think they deserve as much criticism as they did like 18 months ago. I think when you compare how this season has unfolded and the public commentary and some of the work and on, I don't really understand. Like, there's nothing this season from a Rutherford Alvin perspective, I think, that should compare with how badly Boudreau's dismissal was mishandled.
Yeah, okay. If you mean in season,
I mean the whole
saga. I think I agree with you. At some point, though, the discussion of why, like, what went into signing both JT Miller and Elias Pettersson long term, what was that process like? And then ultimately it not working out spectacularly, right? Like, I think that could end up being kind of a glaring misstep to the same extent of a lot of other things.
I mean, sorry, I've repeatedly said
yes
that I didn't think that going all in on this core made sense.
Yes.
I said that well before it was in vogue. In fact, I was saying it as everyone dunked on me windmill style because of their success last season, right? And I was still like, I don't know.
Yeah. But I think it's like it's becoming
even
more of a question now. You know what I mean?
No, but the truth is that Miller was willing to sign up to play long-term with Pettersson, and Pettersson was willing to sign up long-term with Miller, and they coexisted well enough that it worked throughout a season in which they won the Pacific Division and made it to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone thought it was in the past, and Rutherford said it to Gary Mason.
We thought it was done.
And we've realized that it's always going to come back. They can't get past it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
they thought it was done. It flared up again. They realized it was intractable. And sometimes you got to pull the chute for everyone's best interest, right? Like, I think that part of the calculation was JT Miller needs this. So anyway, a massive mess. There's so much that management does that we won't see. But I think the primary way to evaluate, stripped of context, right, is, I'll always say this. I say this a lot about Bill Guerin, for example, because I think the Minnesota Wild do a lot of stuff that I find bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that Guerin reliably crushes is every year on July 1, he signs three guys for $1 million, and all of them are helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Some are more helpful than others. No one's hitting 100% in the bargain bin. But in terms of like reliably identifying value, he does it really well. This organization has done it really well under this management group. And so instead of getting Jay Beagle $4 times $3 million, you're getting Pugh Suter or you're getting Teddy Bluger on a 1-year deal. Like they're finding Sherwood type guys.
Yeah.
And they're missing on Heinen type guys sometimes too. Don't get me wrong. But those misses are completely navigable, right? That you can easily work around them. And they're not overcommitting to players that are not moving the needle for the most part. And they've done it repeatedly. And I think if you have that baseline of identifying value, that's a really good sign of overall organizational competence.
Yeah. And that's why, like, I don't put any stock in the it's Benning 2.0.
No,
it's completely different from like a baseline talent evaluation, all that kind of stuff.
There's still things I don't like, to be clear. I still think the big picture decisions concern me. I still think the Hronek trade was reckless, even if it worked out. I think the Marcus Pettersson trade was reckless. I worry about the Marcus Pettersson trade being like the organization made a reckless bet on JT Miller mm-hmm. with that trade and it worked. Then they did it again with Hronek and then it worked. And all of these deals, right, are like good player for asset that could massively appreciate and really hurt you if it doesn't work out. And ultimately, like, you don't have to hit on too many long shot bets for them to pay off. But if you're betting with a lot of downside, right, it doesn't take a lot either for that loss to be what they call in the gambling industry a jump off the bridge bet.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so, yeah, I mean, I worry about those things. I think this team should have taken a longer view towards surrounding, you know, the sort of Hughes-Pedersen core. I said it repeatedly. We come to this moment, and I don't really think that's a realistic option because Hughes has hit too high a level. And, you know, entertaining, like, do they rip the Band-Aid off? Do they try to have the conversation now?
Man.
I mean, I don't think
that's
so.
That's a tough road to go down.
He's too good.
Yeah.
He's too good.
No, like, one wants that on their resume.
No, and you can spend 50 years looking for the next Quinn Hughes and not find him, by the way. Like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime level player. So, you know, you're going for it. You're going for it. This is an all-in season, and you need to pull off something pretty spectacular, in part because I think big picture, right, in terms of the big decisions and the directional decisions that this organization has made, including at the trade deadline, right, where they missed another opportunity to sort of look long-term and give themselves, like, how, look, it's not a lot, but how helpful would two extra second-round picks be if you want to add two top six forwards this summer?
Yeah.
Would it be a game changer? No. Would you be better off with that than Suter and Besser expiring as your leverage diminishes and four regulation wins in 14 games since?
Yep.
Yeah, obviously. And we kind of knew it on the day.
We did.
So there are things that this organization, I think, is getting wrong and reasonable things to criticize management for. And yet the baseline competence of what we see, the discipline that they've shown in terms of managing the cap, some good work at the draft table, some exceptional work in terms of pro scouting, you know, I still think should earn them some patience to get beyond a season in which an awful lot went wrong and an awful lot went wrong that I think should be put at the feet of players, frankly, this core group, and their inability to partner with one another, more so than on the decisions management made.
Okay, that's the show for today. Canucks are back at practice tomorrow. We will be on the air. Dimitri will join us, of course, as well. Going into another set of two games on the weekend for the Canucks. That's coming up tomorrow here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
It's brunch time.
Well, it's Canucks brunch time with Josh Elliott Wolf and Lena Setegi.
Bring your mimosas, waffles, eggs Benny.
And instead of hot cakes, we've got hot takes from 11 a.m. to noon daily on Sportsnet 650.